Okay, so we're going to now.
All right. Good evening to everyone. So we entitled the lecture tonight, Talking About the Oral Law. Get it? Talking? Oral?
Got it.
It took me, I thought of that for about 2 seconds. So I want to start with a verse at the very end of Vayikra, really the last pasuk. It says, Eila chukim ha-mishpatim ha-toros, asher nasan Hashem beino v'minei Yisrael. These are the statutes, the laws, and the toros, in plural, that God gave him to him from him to the Jewish people. And Rashi there says, comments of course, because we speak of the Torah, and yet the Torah speaks of Torah, two Torahs. Achat b'chtav, achat b'alpeh. One written and one oral. Magid shekulam nitnu l'Moshe b'Sinai. To teach us that all of these were given to Moshe at Sinai. And the Medrash makes this clear. Two Torahs were given to the Jewish people at Sinai. Now this is not, on the one hand, it should be obvious why there's a need for an oral tradition. On the other hand, it's always been very controversial and not always accepted by different sects. So, for example, the primary heresy of the Sadducees in the Second Temple era, or the Karaites a millennium later, was that they denied the oral law and they interpreted the Torah literally. Of course, you see from the case of the Karaites that you can interpret the Torah literally, but nonetheless you still need some type of oral tradition, or none of it makes sense. So what they essentially did was just renounce the rabbinic tradition, the authorized tradition, and created their own. So there have always been challenges, and therefore tonight I want to ask these questions in addition to entertaining whatever questions you have as well. First, what is it, the oral law? How is it developed? Why does it exist? How can it not be flawed, since unlike the Torah, which is God's word given to us, the oral law in some sense is dependent on human beings and human intellects? What is the lingering authority of the oral law, especially when we consider, to paraphrase the modern parlance, the root of it is in the Talmud, is the product of dead white Middle Eastern males, right? That's what it's from. And added to that, the European males who came afterwards down to our day, the American, the Israeli, the European, etc. And if there is an oral tradition, why then are there so many disagreements, right? You take many areas of halacha. Take a simple case of waiting between meat and milk, all right? How many customs are there?
Six and one.
Well, there's even more than that, by the way. Yeah, there's also none, right? Let's say there are four, but even some wait into the fifth hour. Let's say there are a good half dozen customs. So there are many areas of halacha that are like that. So what does it say about an oral tradition? How traditional is it if there could be two people doing two different things at the same time for the same purpose? Let's start with the basics. In number one, the mission at the beginning of Masechet Avot. Moshe received the Torah from Sinai and transmitted it to Yeshua to the elders the prophets transmitted it to the men of the great assembly. So when the Mishnah says that Moshe received the Torah from Sinai, what Torah are we talking about? Well, it can't be the written Torah, because Moshe received that and everyone received that. It was transmitted not just to Yeshua, but it was transmitted to everybody. So when we speak here of Moshe receiving the Torah, which finally made its way to the men of the great assembly at the very beginning of the Second Temple era, we can only be referring to an oral tradition that accompanied the written Torah. Why it's indispensable, we'll see in a few moments, but clearly it's a part and parcel of the Jewish experience. Look at the pasuk. I guess we'll read this in a few weeks in the Torah, in Shemot. And the Lord said to God, write down these matters, for in accordance, al pi hadvarim ha'ela, meaning by the word, literally by the word, by the mouth of these words, in accordance with these matters, I make a covenant with you and with Israel. What is al pi? So al pi is al peh, oral. That is to say, so here's the Gemara in Gittin 60b, Rabbi Elazar says, the majority of the Torah was transmitted in writing, while the minority was transmitted orally. As it is stated, Pasuk in Hosea, in the prophets, I wrote for him the greater part of my Torah. They were reckoned a strange thing. Meaning, that the majority of the Torah is transmitted in written form. Now, obviously, that's not true, so we have to understand what he's talking about. How could the majority of the Torah be transmitted in writing? So my understanding is, when he says here the majority of the Torah, he means the bulk of the mitzvos. In other words, there's 613 mitzvos in the Torah, there's 7 rabbinic. So then you have the majority of the mitzvos in the Torah that are in writing to be extracted from the Torah. But the point to be made here is the following. Rabbi Yochanan says, the majority of the Torah was transmitted orally, al peh, while the minority was transmitted in writing, as it is stated with regard to the giving of the Torah to Moses on Mount Sinai, for on the basis, al pi hadver me'ela, on the basis, through the word of these matters, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel, which indicates that the greater part of the Sinaitic covenant was taught orally. Now, that should be obvious if we just look at the relative size of the volumes. Here we have, all right, so here we have a Tanakh. Okay? It's not even the Torah. The Torah is the first 5 books. Here's a Tanakh. It's a nice sized volume, but it doesn't compare at all to the Talmud. We only have a few volumes here. But the Talmud has 63 tractates. The classic set has 20 volumes, all right? So it's just much larger.
And there's Yerushalmi.
And Yerushalmi as well. And then you add on to that all the commentaries from the Gaonim, the Rishonim, the early authorities, the later authorities. You could fill the entire room, plus, with just the basic staples of a Jewish library, and then the written Torah is just that small book. So we have, in effect, is verification of Rabbi Yochanan's statement that the majority of the Torah was transmitted orally. So the Torah then is given in 2 parts. There's a written part of the Torah that we grasp, that we could see, and there's an oral part that's literally oral, transmitted person to person by word of mouth. Now, Rashi comments, number 4, the majority of the Torah is in writing. The majority of the Torah depend on teachings that are recorded to be expounded in general and specific, and through the hermeneutical principles used to expound the Torah. In other words, how do you get such a expansive oral law? It means, along with the written Torah, Moshe was given formula by which to extract details, laws from the written Torah itself, and that would be handed down to the Jewish people. And now we have a very far-reaching statement. Continue the Gemara in Gittin in number 5. Rabbi Yochanan said, continuing, the Holy One, blessed be He, made a covenant with the Jewish people only for the sake of the matters that were transmitted orally, Baal Peh. As it is written, from the basis, Al Pi, these matters, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. The essential covenant between us and God is through the oral law. It's what relates us directly to God. It's what gives the Torah its vibrancy, its relevance, its applicability. It gives us the means to adapt to every new situation, and therefore, it's the symbol of the special relationship that we have with God. Now, this is actually elaborated upon by Rav Kook. It's on the flip side, number 18, from a commentary Rav Kook wrote early when he was relatively young, called Midbar Shur. Rav Kook was the first chief rabbi of the land of Israel. 2 Torahs. So he said, God divided the Torah, our guide to fulfill our spiritual missions, into 2 components, the written law and the oral law. The written Torah was revealed to the entire world. All nations can access these teachings. God commanded that the Torah be written in a clear script, Beretev, in 70 languages, so that it would be accessible to all peoples. The written Torah was meant to enlighten the entire world. Stop for a moment. Is that true? Absolutely. How many people on the globe embrace the written Torah in one form or another? In the billions. Very few of them happen to be Jews. But people by the billions embrace the written Torah as the word of God. So the written Torah was meant to be accessible to others. So for example, Christianity embraces what they call the Old Testament as the word of God. So they have their own theories what came afterwards. Islam embraces also the Bible, both old and new as the Christians say, as the forerunners to the Quran. But nonetheless, both religious groups, and together have like a little over 3 billion people in the world, maybe 3.5 billion, both of them accept the written Torah as the basis of everything. And we see this in America today. You know, speak about people in the Bible Belt, the fundamentalists. Yeah, they believe the Bible is all true. Those books, both the books of Moses and the entire Bible itself, all right? To our shame, the average evangelical knows the Tanakh better than we do. They quote chapter and verse off the top. And the Mormons also. They quote chapter and verse very, very easily. So that's the written Torah. So the written Torah, therefore, since it was meant to be the guide for all mankind, is not the essence of the covenant. What's the essence of the covenant? Let's continue in Rav Kook. The oral law, on the other hand, belongs solely to the Jewish people. Since this part of the Torah was not meant to be committed to writing, it is of more concealed and less universal nature. In truth, the oral law is simply the received explanation of the written law transmitted over the generations. Thus, even the written Torah is only fully accessible to Israel through the oral Torah. But the other nations, nevertheless, merit a limited understanding of the written Torah. See, other nations really base their framework, they distorted it eventually, but they base their framework on the written Torah. But our framework of even understanding the written Torah and giving it its full explication is going to be the oral Torah. Oral Torah is the only way to keep the Torah alive and vibrant and relevant. Now, the truth is, it was written down of necessity. It's not a preference. On the contrary, the Gemara says that it was because of the persecutions at the time of the second destruction of the temple, and immediately thereafter, Jews could no longer learn Torah in serenity. Jews are on the run, and since the oral Torah literally means sitting down with a teacher, learning it from the teacher, so therefore, if you're on the run, can't sit, and don't have the presence of mind or complacency to do it, so therefore, they decided to write it down first in the Mishnah, around the year 200, and then the Talmud itself, the Gemara, the Mishnah put together, achieved its final form in the year 475, like yesterday. It's not that far off. The year 475. Now, this is what took Moshe 40 days on the mountains to apprehend. It wasn't just the tablets. The tablets, you know, you get an electric stylus, you carve out the tablets. God did anyway. That took a couple minutes. But it was 40 days. Of course, 40 days for Moshe is like 400 years for us. But he was able to apprehend the essence of the Torah, meaning the 613 commandments, the Torah itself, as well as the formula by which the principles of the Torah would be expounded over the years. That's what he did up on the mountain. Number six, the Lord said to Moses, that was last week's Torah reading, come up to me on the mountain and wait there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the teachings and commandments which I've inscribed to instruct them. Laharasam, to instruct them. What does that mean? It means there's more to the Torah than just the words that are written on the scroll. Again, we'll see why it has to be like that. But there's more to it. And here the Gemara in Brachos stuff 5a, Rabbi Levi Bar Chama said, Rav Shimon Lakish said, God said to Moses, ascend to me on the mountain and be there. And I'll give you the stone tablets and the Torah and the mitzvah that I've written that you may teach them. Meaning that God revealed to Moses not only the written Torah, but all of Torah, as it would be transmitted through the generations. The tablets are the Ten Commandments that were written on the tablets of the covenant. The Torah is the five books of Moses. Mitzvah is the Mishnah, explanation of the mitzvahs. That I have written refers to the prophets and writings, written with divine inspiration. That you may teach them refers to the Talmud, which explains the Mishnah. These explanations are the foundation for the rulings of practical halacha. This verse teaches that all aspects of Torah were given to Moses from Sinai. And to make the point even stronger, it's a famous midrash that appears in a number of places. I cite it here, number 8, Vayikra Rabbah 22. And the Lord God gave me the two tablets of stone inscribed by the finger of God with the exact words the Lord addressed to you on the mountain out of the fire on the day of the assembly. You shall faithfully observe all the instruction that I enjoin upon you today, that you may thrive and increase and be able to possess the land that the Lord promised on oath to your fathers. Rish Lakish said, all. What's all? Like all mitzvah. The mitzvah, scripture, Mishnah, laws, Talmud, Agadot, and even what an experienced disciple will say before his teacher were all already said to Moshe at Sinai. As it says, Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, sometimes there is a phenomenon of which they say, look, this one is new. To that his friend will respond, it occurred long since, in ages that went by before us. There's really nothing new. That is a far-reaching statement. Even what an experienced disciple will say before his teacher were all already said to Moshe at Sinai. How could that be? I'll give you an example. You'll give me a better one.
No, I have a question.
Yes.
I've always understood this, that both the oral and written were at Sinai, and I get that, but I've always been puzzled. Moshe got the Torah with his whole life and what's going to happen at that moment.
Moshe at Sinai, actually before Sinai, before he ascended the mountain, wrote the entire Torah up to that point.
That's what I was
dictated about, up to that point. Okay. It's really at the end of last week's Sedra. It says, Vaichtov, Moshe wrote, Kol Dvarim, up to that point, meaning through, from the beginning, from Bereishis, from creation, the stories of our forefathers, Egypt, and then everything that happened up to that point, all right? And then over the course of the 40 years in the wilderness, the rest of the Torah was given to them. Some say it was given in scrolls, others say it was just written down, and at the end of the 40 years, Moshe gave each tribe its own Torah scroll to have the written Torah memorialized. But let's unpack the statement for a second. Even what an experienced disciple will say before his teacher were already said to Moshe at Sinai. Meaning, if Rav Pini would suggest something based on some new phenomenon that exists around us today, and say the halach is such and such, all right? Let's say it refers to electricity or cyber or something or other. So how then would we say that an experienced disciple, like Rav Pini, said something that Moses at Sinai said? How would Moses at Sinai know about these things? All right? So now we come to the one of the most interesting phenomenon of this oral law. And that is, I noted that Moshe was given the Torah, the mitzvahs, as well as the formula by which everything would unfold. So therefore, it doesn't necessarily mean that Moshe would comprehend the specific application of a halacha, a principle, but what he would be able to comprehend is the flow. He'd be able to trace back the decision through to its original source, which would be in the Gemara, which would be in eventually the Torah, in one of the verses in the Torah. That's what it means. There's nothing that develops in the world of Torah that is nothing that's properly developed in the world of Torah that's outside the framework of what Moshe Rabbeinu, what Moses our teacher, taught us at Sinai. In fact, what he learned directly from God at Sinai. The system in that self is self-contained, in that sense, is self-contained, but it awaits explication. And each generation, and now the technological advances of the last 20 years, certainly half century, obviously century and a half, have, I think from if an outsider looks at it, they wonder, what does the Torah have to say about cars or planes or the things that you do on social media, etc.? What does the Torah say about these things? And yet, you see, there's so much literature today on these issues of what the Torah says. And not because someone 50, 100 years ago wrote about it, anticipated it, but rather the principles that were given to us, those principles are what were given to Moshe at Sinai with the methodology of interpreting them, and those are the same principles that in each generation guide us into ascertaining what precisely God's will is. I want to skip for one moment to number 10. And we'll see something very fascinating about the oral Torah. Because again, remember what the Gemara said. Yes, please.
So I always understood this as what I was saying, but when you get down to when they started writing down the Torah, and then there was debates in the Mishnah and in the Gemara, even the framework, it's all debated within the framework, but then it becomes two completely separate streams of debates of what's right versus what's wrong, or what's principle, what's not.
Right, so let's get back to that issue. How is it possible that there's so many disputes?
Well, yeah, tell me the disputes and Mishnah disputes. So all those laws, right, that wasn't Moses per se, the framework.
Right. Okay, we'll get to that in 5 minutes. All right, hold the thought. It's a good question. Yes.
Can you just give a specific example? You're trying to say that the principles are eternal, the applications are constantly changing. So give an example and say...
Well, take the simple example of an automobile.
Okay.
All right? So obviously in the time of the Talmud, they did not contemplate there'd be such a thing as automobiles. So therefore, how would they deal with combustion? A fuel injection system, an electric car. What does the Talmud, what does the written Torah have to say about this? What's that? That's correct. That's correct. Now, it's interesting. The Gemara does have a concept of a migdal ha-porech bavir, a tower that flies through the air, something that we know as an
airplane.
Correct. Apparently, they thought it was feasible, but they didn't know how it would. But the Gemara does discuss various applications of that idea. But nonetheless, you talk simply of a combustion engine, all right? So there is and let's say it's a Shabbos question. So there is an issue on Shabbos of mavir, of eish, of fire, all right? We deal with electricity in a variety of ways. Is it like fire? Is it like some other halachic principle? So when you break down each new issue to its roots, all right, to its to the building blocks, eventually you're going to come in every issue to something on which the Torah has, if not precise guidance, at the very least, very good guidance. And I say if not precise, because you have to give Jews something to argue about. But so some will say, and this is exactly what a machlokas is, like you were saying before. Some people will analogize it to this case. Others will analogize it to another case. And both really could be true. Both these and those are the words of the living God. We need a psak, we need finality, but nonetheless, both possibilities exist. I want to hold off on that and see the relationship between the written Torah and the oral Torah in the commentary of Rav Hirsch, Rav Shamshel Raphael Hirsch, number 10. He, of course, was the great leader of German Jewry in Frankfurt in the for a good part of the 19th century. So the question he's asking is, again, on last week's Torah reading. The Torah begins its discussion of civil law with some extraordinary cases. The case of the Eved Ivri, the Hebrew servant who sold into slavery, the Amoha Ivriya, the female servant, really a case where a father, out of poverty, sells his daughter into servitude. So the cases are very extreme. The point that Rav Hirsch makes is that from each of those cases, we derive exactly the rights of all people. Meaning, we choose to derive the rights of all from the guarantee of the rights that are given to the least fortunate in any society. And anyway, that's the issue that he's dealing with, and then he touches on our point here tonight. Then we can well understand that if just the exceptional cases which principally come to be described, that just from them, the normal general principles of justice and humanity may be more strikingly realized. Then we can understand how it is that the general principles of justice are altogether not so much given in this book, but preferably single concrete cases. And these are described in the book in such an instructive manner that the principles which underlie them and which have been entrusted to the living minds and living practice of the people can easily be seen from them. Then we can understand how the language used in this book is so skillfully chosen that often by the use of a striking expression, an unusual altered construction, the position of a word, a letter, etc., a whole train of ideas of justice and human rights is indicated. After all, it was not out of this book that the law was to have been acquired. This book was to be given to the hands of those who were already well informed in the law, simply as a means of retaining and of reviving ever afresh this knowledge which have been entrusted to their memories, and also to the teachers of the law, as a means of teaching to which the students go for references to the traditional actual laws, so that the written sentences lying before them would make it easy for them to recall to their minds the knowledge they had received orally. And now we come to the critical point, and you see how he relates the oral law to the written law. The Torah Shebichsav, meaning the written law, is to be to the Torah Shebapeh, the oral law, in the relation of short notes on a full and extensive lecture on any scientific subject. For the student who has heard the whole lecture, short notes are quite sufficient to bring back afresh to his mind at any time the whole subject of the lecture. For him, a word, an added mark of interrogation, exclamation, a dot, the underlining of a word, etc., is often quite sufficient to recall to his mind a whole series of thoughts or remark, etc. Just to stop for a moment, if I'm speaking some, I take notes, so I don't write it the whole sentence. It's enough to write it a word. Sometimes two words and I'll underline one, and that triggers the train of thought that I want to say. It's true if anyone who takes writes shorthand. That's probably passé today, right? I didn't know it either. But I used to see even the stenographers in court when I was a lawyer, you know, it's like gibberish they're typing. How do you figure it out? It's because the symbols, the marks, it makes sense to them. All right? That's what the Torah is, Rav Hirsch says. The written Torah is a word here, a word there, that triggers associations and mounds of halachos. So, for example, when you get to learn Gemara, you'll see sometimes the sages will derive, there's a vav here, all right? This word is repeated here. So it seems arbitrary. It's not arbitrary. It's because they knew already the explication, and now they look in the Torah and they see, well, why is it written like this? It's written so as to trigger the thought that we should know exactly that the oral Torah is rooted in the written Torah. For those who had not heard the lecture from the master, such notes would be completely useless. If they were to try to reconstruct the scientific contents of their lecture literally from such notes, they would of necessity make many errors. Words, marks, etc., which serve the scholars who had heard the lecture as instructive guiding stars to the wisdom that had been taught and learned, stare the uninitiated as unmeaning sphinxes. The wisdom, the truths which the initiated reproduce from them, but do not produce out of them, are sneered at by the uninitiated as being merely a clever, witty play of words and empty dreams without any real foundation. So go back to Rav Kook right next in 18 when he said the written Torah is accessible to the entire world. It is. But what's accessible to them is only the simple words that are before them. They don't have access to what underlies the words. They haven't heard the lecture, so to speak, to use Rav Hirsch's analogy. So therefore they see the words and they derive, you know, it's literal. They're literalists, fundamentalists, etc. We were never in that position because to us the words and the lecture always formed a coherent and cohesive whole. Yes, sir.
So I'm learning brachot now.
Okay.
And I just learned that, like, I think an example of this is when you see the word Ish in Torah, it refers to Gavriel. And then if you see...
Well, it depends on the context.
Okay.
But you're right. Many times. Ish,
right,
is used, and sometimes it will include women, sometimes exclude women, sometimes refers to your case, I think you're talking about Yosef, right? The Imsaehu Ish, a man found him, right? Or even Hashem Ish Milchama. So each time the word Ish is used, it can have a different meaning. But if you just look at the translation, man, it looks like the same thing. But if you know the lecture or have access to it, now like we have access to the Talmud, so we'll understand exactly what the greater whole, what each word is supposed to mean. Okay, that's what Rav Hirsch is saying. So when we have the written Torah is holy because it's God's word, but the written Torah is so pregnant, each word, with layers and layers of meaning that are not accessible to the average person. It's only accessible to the initiated. Who are the initiated? Those who learn. Those who want to study Torah. They become the initiated. It's no more complex than that. Not to mention that it is complex on some level. Anybody who wants to learn opens up the Torah, find a teacher, find a rabbi, and then you become part of the initiated, and you see how the words of the Torah come to life. Note, by the way, something very interesting. God gave Moshe tablets, luchot, on the mountains. All right, what are those luchot? Luchot have on it the Decalogue. Rabbi Sadragon said the Decalogue is a synopsis of the 613 commandments. Because implicit in each of the 10, they're just categories. The 10 categories that give rise to all the other mitzvot in one way or another. By the same token, the written Torah is essentially a synopsis of the oral Torah. Because the oral Torah is always traceable back. So many times the Gemara will say, my kra, my dichsiv, what's your pasuk, what's your verse, what's your source? Because it can't just be in the air that you fabricate a conclusion. It has to be rooted in a source, and that source has to be rooted in tradition as well. Now, but for the oral law, the Torah would have been frozen, would have become desiccated, in fact, unwieldy and really unusable. Look at number 11. It's a very interesting source in the Talmud Yerushalmi in Sanhedrin. Rabbi Yannai said, if the Torah had been given as a book of fixed laws, it would not have endured. All right? Why would that be? What is the meaning then? And God said to Moshe, Moshe said to God, Master of the universe, tell me the law. We want to know. What's the law? God said to him, follow the majority. As the Torah can be expounded 49 ways to purify and 49 ways to impurify. Meaning from God's perspective, you could have many legitimate options within the law. Of course, there's a methodology of deciding the law that you have to follow. We're bound by that as servants of God to surrender. That becomes His will. But in theory, you can argue many cases, not all, but many cases, in a variety of ways. Now this is brought to us in even starker form in number 9. It's a very long source that discusses the oral law. It's in the Gemara Chagiga 3b. Let's read it and we'll discuss it, because it'll answer a number of questions that arise. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah also commenced his lecture and taught. It is written, the words of the sages are as goads, and as nails well fastened are those that are composed in collections. They are given from one shepherd. All right, why are the matters of Torah compared to a goad? Just to tell you, just as this goad directs the cow or a furrow to bring forth sustenance for life to the world, so too the words of Torah direct those who study them from the paths of death to the paths of life. I mean, a goad is like a stick. What do we know from animals in Manhattan? It's a stick. It keeps the cow on the path so it doesn't stray. So too, the words of Torah direct us to living life the proper way. The Gemara asks, if so, derive the following from that same analogy. Just as this goad is movable and not rigid, so too, matters of Torah are movable in accordance with circumstance and are not permanent. Therefore, the verse states, nails well fastened, nails are permanent. If so, one can explain as follows. Just as this nail is diminished in size and does not expand, as it wastes away over time, so too matters of Torah gradually diminish and do not expand. Therefore the verse states, no, well fastened nituim. What's nituim? A neta, lintoa, is a plant. Just as this plant flourishes and multiplies, so too matters of Torah flourish and multiply. And that's what's happened to the Torah. From the relatively modest written Torah, it flourished, it expanded, because the discussions that take place on the written Torah are really infinite in scope. And bear in mind that the oral Torah is still oral, in essence. There is a Gemara written down that became a framework, but nonetheless it's still transmitted teacher to student, from generation to generation. It's not something you can just read like a book and move on. It still has to be taught in terms of methodology. Next, those that are composed in collections, Balei Sefot, these are Torah scholars who sit in many groups and engage in Torah study. There are often debates among these groups, like you said before. Often, all the time. As some of these sages render an object, a person, ritually impure, these render it pure. These prohibit an action. These permit it. These deem an item invalid. These deem it valid. Lest the person say, now how can I study Torah when it contains so many different opinions? The verse states, they're all given from one shepherd. Nitnu Meroe Echod. One God gave them. One leader, Moses, said them from the mouth of the master of all creation, blessed be he, as it is written, and God spoke all these words. The plural form words indicates that God transmitted all the interpretations of the Ten Commandments. Since the sages invariably utilized the Torah itself, or the statements of the prophets, as the sources for their opinions, there's a certain unity to the study of Torah, despite the numerous explanations and applications. Why would there be so many disputes in Torah? Why would there be? Well, like I mentioned before, because people's minds are different. And if you have a new case, some will analogize it to X and others to Y, still some others to Z. And that in the academy, they'll thrash about, they'll discuss which is the most appropriate analogy, and then they'll move forward from that. Sometimes it's not settled. But I think it's important to realize that in most cases, the law is pretty clear. When you get down into the weeds, then you'll find different distinctions, especially not on the level of Torah law, but on the level of either rabbinic law or custom. That's where you find most of the disputes. Consider this and be amazed by it. The Torah was given in 2448 to creation, all right? The first machloket, the first dispute in halacha, arose roughly three centuries before the Churban. So let's say that was about 40. We went a good 13 centuries without having an argument. How's that possible? Jews don't go 13 minutes without an argument today. How'd you go 13 centuries? It's because when the Torah was all oral, when the oral Torah was all oral, it was a tradition. You had a question, you went to the rabbi, went to the court, the Sanhedrin, and they decided, nothing to fight about. But once you start recording things, putting things in writing, then the next generation becomes more fixed. And the next generation argues, well, what did he mean by this? What does that mean? What does this mean? All right? You have this, by the way, now in constant contracts. People always argue about what was meant in a contract, but you have the Constitution until today. It's a good analogy, by the way. You have First Amendment, Second Amendment, and people argue today what was meant. Does the intention of the founders matter? How we interpret it today, etc. It's a very good analogy. It stops at a certain point because not divine, but nonetheless, the idea of having a written law, call it the Constitution and the amendments, and an oral law, which would essentially be the Supreme Court decisions on that, and you have a very rough approach to how we understand it as well. Would anyone look to the Constitution to try to derive modern practice, not just modern jurisprudence, but modern practice? You'd be insane to do that. It would not make any sense. It's written in generalities. So the originalists, of course, want to go back to what they had in mind. You can figure that out. But in the Torah, we have a different methodology. The methodology is trying to ascertain as best we can what Moshe was told at Sinai. Since that is not always accessible to us, what we have then is a long tradition of discussions on each particular area, and from that long discussion, we derive the principles and corollaries and formula by which we relate it to new situations. Now, there's something else even more interesting that relates to the indispensability of Torah also. Look at number 16. It's in Dvarim. If the place where the Lord has chosen to establish His name is too far from you, you may slaughter any of the cattle or sheep that the Lord gives you, as I have commanded you, and you may eat to your heart's content in your settlements. All right. Making us hungry. What's it talking about? It's one of the basic Jewish practices, kosher slaughter. All right, how do we slaughter animals? Oh, we don't. We let others do it for us. But look at number 17, the Gemara in Chulin 28a, as I have commanded you. In other words, all the Torah said is that v'zavachta, you'll slaughter the animals, God says to Moses, kasher tzivisicha, as I have commanded you. Where did God command Moshe how to slaughter animals? You would search the five books of Moses in vain for that. All God said, as I commanded you, meaning it was oral. Number 17, as I have commanded to teach us that Moshe was commanded about the trachea and the esophagus, the two simanim, trachea and the windpipe, the trachea and the esophagus, that have to be cut, and most of one sign in fowl, most of two signs in animals. In other words, God told Moshe that very basic practice, which is at the root of the kosher food industry and consumption, that was oral. That's not written in the Torah. You have so many other things that we take for granted, all right? For example, the Torah speaks of pre-Eitz Hadar and Etrog that we use on Sukkot. Does the Torah define what a pre-Eitz Hadar is? No. We always knew what it was. From the time Moshe was told on Sinai, it was passed down from generation to generation. No one thought it was a lemon, an apple, etc. We always knew it was a citron. Same thing with kosher slaughter. There was never machloket about that. Never a dispute. We always knew what it was. Or tefillin. Does the Torah describe what tefillin is? No, it just says totafot. We don't even know what that word means. The Gemara says that's an African term. We don't know what the word means. How do we know what tefillin are? It's because from generation to generation, going back to Moses at Sinai, that's what it was. You remember the story of Bar Kochba's tefillin? They dug up Bar Kochba's tefillin, I think it was in the Qumran caves. It's exactly the same tefillin we have now. Exactly the same tefillin. Except it was Rabbeinu Tam, you should know.
Yeah.
But exactly the same tefillin, all right? The Torah is the exact same Torah. Or take a simple case. The laws of Shabbos, melachot, the forbidden labors on Shabbos. Does the Torah discuss them at any length? What labors does the written Torah discuss? It discusses not carrying, and it discusses not lighting a fire. 2 out of 39. Where are the others from? It's all oral. So when the Torah says that on Shabbat, lo taseh kol melacha, and God forbid it's a capital crime, don't do any forbidden labor, the Torah doesn't describe what the forbidden labors are. How then did we know? Because that's the oral Torah. That's why the Torah does not make any sense unless we say there's a corresponding oral tradition that accompanies it and that is able to give good guidance to us. So it's really baked into the system. Not only that, look at number 14. Which is the source for this notion of rabbinic authority. If a case is too baffling for you to decide, be it a controversy or over homicide, civil or assault, matters of dispute in your courts, you shall promptly repair to the place of the Lord your God will have chosen, meaning Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, appear before the Levitical priest or the magistrate in charge of the time, present your problem. When they have announced to you the verdict in the case, you shall carry the verdict that is announced to you from the place that the Lord chose, observing scrupulously all their instructions to you. You shall act in accordance with the instructions given you and the ruling handed down to you. You must not deviate from the word that they tell you, either to the right or to the left. This is one of the 613 commandments. In other words, the system is not left to chance. It's not ad hoc. It's not random. If a person doesn't know what to do, find what to do. And here's Rashi. Number 15, you must not deviate from the word they tell you, neither to the right nor to the left. Even if the judge, tells you about what appears to you to be right, that it is left. Or about what appears to you to be left, that is right, you have to obey him. That's what the system is. That's authority. How much more so is this so if he actually tells you about what is evidently right, that it is right, and about what is left, that it is left. So, of course, it's not left haphazard. It's not left to the subjective whims of every individual. It's rather given over to the authorities from generation to generation to give guidance. How do you know that it's right? Right? How's the game of telephone work? You say one thing, by the end, it's totally garbled. Look at number 13, the Medj Kohelet Rabbah. It's the same verse that we quoted in number 9 from Kohelet. Divrei Chachamim Kadar Vonot is the pasuk. The words of the sage are like goads, Kadar Vonot. What does that sound like in Hebrew? Kadar Vonot? So the Medrash expounds, like a Kadur Banot, like a girl's ball. Think of a Spalding. When you play telephone, the message becomes garbled because you're whispering. It's not clear. It's not a solid substance that's being handed. Just like a ball is transferred hand to hand and does not fall to the ground, so too the words of Torah are never lost. Thus Moshe received the Torah at Sinai, transmitted to Yeshua, Yeshua to the prophets, etc., all the way down to our day. That's how it happens. So it's not telephone. It's exactly the opposite.
But how can you prove that it was never changed?
that, what was never changed?
That it went from Moshe to Yahushua and so forth, even though it may not have been like telephone. How do we know for sure?
So take some of the basics that I mentioned, like the halacha of Moshe Mitzrayim, things that we trace, like an etrog or tefillin, etc. We have no record, and we do have even archaeological evidence and other records, like the tefillin I mentioned, Bar Kochva, that it was exactly the same. So someone would have to say that it's changed. And obviously certain things have changed. For example, we don't have a sacrificial order in the temple. But nonetheless, they existed in composite 830 years. So we have a record of what took place there. It's in the Talmud. So God's help, one day I'll have a temple again. We'll be able to, you know, hit the ground running. We'll know what it is. Yeah, we'll argue about it also. But nonetheless, we'll be able to find our way and consult the leaders of the generation to ascertain that. But you take other issues like Shabbat, Kashrut, etc. You would have to say that there was a time in the early First Temple era, or let's say late Second Temple era, that pork was kosher and steak was not. All right, we have no record of that. All right, it's exactly the opposite. We know the types of animals that they slaughtered. Okay, it's an amazing story. I mean, I saw it with my own eyes. Before the temple was built in Jerusalem, the one of the tabernacles existed in the town of Shiloh. Shiloh is north of Yerushalayim.
We all went there.
You went there, and you saw the tabernacle there, and you saw the bones. You saw the bones where the bones were.
The plates.
The plates are one thing of broken plates. They found when they first excavated the area that beyond a certain ridge, they found all these animal bones. Meaning you could eat certain things, you could eat kachim only when you could see Pnei HaBayit, you could see the Mishkan. Alright, that was the ridge from where they could see, and they found all these bones going back 3,000 or 3,200 years, okay, because that's where they ate. You see, there's a continuity in Jewish life which is really amazing to behold. You know, it's funny, if you travel in America, like, what's old in America? Ever go to Colonial Williamsburg? I mean, it's a couple of hundred years old, all right? For a Jew, a couple hundred years old is yesterday, all right? We're going back thousands of years. We have proof of ancestors thousands of years. I'm from the tribe of Levi, for example. That goes back to Yaakov's son, all right? That's how far we go back. Anyone here a Kohen or a Levi? Just me, all right? What's that?
Ben, what are you, a Cohen or a Levi?
Cohen.
There you go.
My cousin. All right. Screw up. I'll ask you for a loan after the class. Now that we're family. So you see, we go back such a long way that when we speak of ancient history, we go back thousands of years. And we see the continuity. We see what they said. They just found, in fact, they dug up at the Kotel, some coin or plate that had on it the pasuk. It wasn't Shema Yisrael. It was something else. But you see the how the system always existed, and how even the mighty torrents of rain and hurricanes, and I'm using euphemisms for persecution, none of that could quench the love that we have for God. Yes?
Well, I guess to expand on that a little bit, how do you differentiate between Orla and like the differences that we see in Minhagim?
Yes, that's a good question. Okay, so let's understand Machloket. How is it possible that you have a tradition? So part of it comes from the fact, as the Gemara says, when persecutions came and we were more staggered, they couldn't learn as well, and so they wound up with different interpretations of certain, you know, minutiae, all right? In which case, they gave rise to different traditions. Take some basic examples. We mentioned before eating milk after meat. So all the Torah says is you can't eat an item that's cooked together with meat and milk. So what Chazal did is they made a siyag, a fence. And the question is, according to one opinion, you could have a steak dinner, all right, bench, and then drink milk right away because you're not eating it together. So that opinion never really caught on. But you have the Dutch wait 1 hour, the Germans 3, some 6, others like me, some into the 6th hour. But all those are, shall we say, in the penumbra of customs. They're not the laws. They just developed in different ways for a variety of reasons, stringencies, some related to geography, like where meals took place staggered by 6 hours, then a six-hour rule would pertain, where meals were closely bunched together, so it didn't make any sense to wait that amount of time. But take another common one that plagues us every Pesach time. Kidneyot, right, Ashkenazim, and rice, and beans, and peas, etc. I just lectured last month on Chacham Avadja Yosef. I have a series on great rabbis of the 20th century. And when he became the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he was going through the guidelines for Pesach, and the guidelines, because we lived in a very Ashkenazic-centric world, the guidelines said that kidneyot, legumes, are prohibited on Pesach, but Sfardim are permitted to eat them. He refused to sign off on it. He said, that's not the halacha. And he changed it to read, kidneyot are permitted on Pesach, but Ashkenazim have a custom to be stringent. He completely reversed it. And he was right. In terms of technicalities, he's right. That's what it is. So why the stringencies arose, that's a different matter. Each case to its own. There it related to the fact that in the Arabian countries, they never mingled rice and wheat. In fact, rice wasn't even indigenous to the area, whereas other in the European countries they did, and that's how it developed over time. So most of those types of distinctions arose because of geography, because of lack of attendance to what was being taught, or simply because without guidance, the traditions develop in different ways. But those are really in the weeds, in the minutia. It seems like we argue about many more things than we do, and of course when it comes to minhagim, people are more passionate arguing for the minhag than, you know, minhag is more powerful, is a more powerful explication of the law than even you shouldn't steal, all right? Steal, you find a way around it. But minhag, that you're not going to give up on. Yes. Yeah, question? I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
Right. So if you look at number 19, it's the Gemara in Erevin 6b. But do we adopt the respective stringencies of two authorities who disagree on a series of issues? Wasn't it taught in a Braita? The Allah is always in accordance with the opinion of Beit Hillel. But one who wishes to act in accordance with the opinion of Beit Shammai may do so. And one who wishes to act in accordance with the opinion of Beit Hillel may do so. This applied only until they decide Allah is like Beit Hillel. But here's the point. If he wishes to adopt both the leniencies of Beit Shammai and also the leniencies of Beit Hillel, he's a wicked person. All right? That is, of course, a very modern trait. You can Google leniencies, all right? And you'll find all the leniencies you want.
Shopping for Hector.
Shopping, correct. If he wishes to adopt both the stringencies of Beit Shammai and also the stringencies of Beit Hillel, with regard to him, the verse states, the fool walks in darkness. Meaning to choose the leniencies all the time, that's a rasha, it's a wicked person. To choose the stringencies all the time, that's a shota, that's a ksil, a fool. Rather, he should act either in accordance with Beit Shammai, following both their leniencies and their stringencies, when it comes with Beit Hillel, following both their leniencies and the stringencies, and of course, I said, only up to the point where the halacha was decided. What then becomes the bottom line? Number 12, the bottom left. Yashim Prachya says, make for yourself a teacher, asei l'charav. You have to find a teacher who will guide you with if any questions come up. So machloket really gives us the opportunity to fully express all the dimensions of Torah, every possibility, and that has not yet been exhausted, not by any stretch, but at the end of the day, there has to be psak in these areas as well. Who decides? So they always use, I always use this analogy. Can anybody here read an x-ray? Okay. All right, I hate to say this, but I can read an x-ray. I could see if something is fractured. I can't read an x-ray like a radiologist can read an x-ray, but I could tell if a bone is fractured. The Torah is the same way. Everybody could look at the Torah and try to understand, oh, this must mean this, and therefore that means that. But when the Talmud Chacham, when the sage looks at the Torah, he's like the radiologist looking at the x-ray. He sees into the Torah much more. He sees the patterns. He sees the principles. He has the weight of tradition. He has an understanding of even more global, broader issues that might impact on a particular case. That's a Asei L'Charav. You have to find a teacher because the teacher is the radiologist reading the x-ray. Nobody would want to rely on me reading the x-ray, all right? And I see from your reaction, you shouldn't do it yourselves either. Even though on some basic level, you could see something that's broken, but you're not going to see most of what there is to see. And very, very likely you're going to miss some essences that you should see. The Torah is the same way. That's why you can't just look into, you can't even just look into the Shulchan Aruch and say, that's going to apply to me. I come across this all the time. People will learn something on their own, worse, they'll Google it, and they'll wind up being stringent when they didn't have to be stringent. And it affects families, marriages, homes, children, etc. No, you have to ask. You have to ask, and you'll see the panoply of variables that are before us, and from there we're able to derive the halacha. I'll end with this on this week's Sedra. It's a beautiful idea. I heard from Rabbi Yaakov Ariel, who recently was the chief rabbi of Ramat Gan. So the Holy Ark in the Mishkan, how was it built? It had three compartments. It had gold, it was a gold box. Inside the gold box was a wooden box. And inside the wooden box was another gold box. Exactly. You have a sandwich of two gold boxes around one wooden box. So the question is why? No one will ever see the wooden box. Even the Kohen Gadol who enters the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, Yom Kippur, he only sees the gold. He's not going to see the wood. So the Aaron, of course, holds the Torah. What's the Torah? The Torah is gold. Gold is precious, but gold is also rigid. It's fixed, okay? The bottom line of the Torah, the written Torah, is really fixed. But placed on top of the written Torah is a wooden box. What's wood? Wood is alive. Wood grows. Wood is vibrant. Wood can develop. Wood can flourish. That's what the Torah Shabbat is. Wood flourishes, so you want the wood on top of the gold. Why then is another gold box on top of that? Because it's not a free-for-all. You're still operating within a fixed system. So there's leeway, there's flexibility, but the flexibility is all within the system. It's not outside the system. If you want to understand how halacha develops, so that's the eights. That's the wooden box that's on top of the bottom gold box. But there are limits as well. There are boundaries. There's a clear delineation in halacha of what is within the system and without the system, and that's the gold box on top. That basically is the oral law, and it's the oral law that, as we saw, sustains us until today and is the very basis of the covenant that exists between God and the Jewish people. All right?
Thank you.
Now, I understand, you're welcome. I understand the next time we meet, there was a request to speak about the Messianic Age. All right? I don't want to be in the position of hoping the Mashiach doesn't come between now and then so I can talk about it. But, all right, if he comes, then we'll discuss it in Yerushalayim. If not, we'll meet here again next month. All right. Okay, thank you.